Patience is not one of my virtues, Ben, Laren continued. I was reading of the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb last night. Lord Carnarvon made the discovery possible, and yet he died before he could look on the sarcophagus of the dead pharaoh. Don't be morbid, Lo. All right, Laren agreed. But don't waste time, Ben. You get Hamilton for me, I said. We can't do a thing without him. I'll be in London on Friday, Laren told me. I'll see him myself. He's a difficult old codger, I warned him. Laren grinned. Ah, you leave him to me. Now, listen to me, Benjamin, my boy. If you find anything else here, you let me know immediately, you understand? I want to be here when it happens. When what happens? I don't know. Something. There is something else here, Ben. I know it. I hope you're right, Lo. And he clapped my shoulder and walked away into the night towards his own hut. While we worked on in the archives, lifting the human remains and the piles of weapons, a construction crew arrived on the site by Dakota to erect a repository for the scrolls. This was another large prefabricated warehouse fitted with airtight doors and a powerful air conditioning unit to maintain the scrolls in an atmosphere of optimum temperature and humidity. A high barbed wire fence was erected round the building for security reasons, and every precaution for the safety of the scrolls was taken. At the same time, the construction crew erected another half dozen living quarters for the expanded team. And the first inhabitants of these were four high officials of the Botswana government. It was the government who had forbidden the removal of the scrolls from the territory and made the erection of the new buildings necessary. The government deputation stayed for 2 days and left, satisfied that their interests in the discovery would be adequately protected, but not before I had exacted a solemn promise of secrecy. The announcement of the site would be at my signal only. We began labeling and removing the pottery jars from their shelves, taking the greatest pains to record, both photographically and by written notes, the exact position of each. It seemed likely that they'd been stacked in chronological order, and this would assist the work of interpretation. On the Monday, I received a crippling blow to my plans in the form of a laconic message from Laren. Hamilton unavailable. Please suggest alternative. I was disappointed, hurt, and angry. Disappointed because Hamilton was the best in the world, and his presence would have immediately given weight and authenticity to my sight. I was hurt because Hamilton obviously believed my claims were spurious. My reputation had been damaged by the vicious attacks of my critics and scientific opponents. Hamilton had clearly been influenced by this. He did not want to be party to some mistaken or blatantly fraudulent discovery of mine. Finally, I was angry because Hamilton's refusal to undertake the work was a direct insult. He had put the mark of the pariah on me, and it would discourage others from giving the assistance I desperately needed. I might find myself discredited before I'd even started. He didn't even give me a chance, I protested to Sally. Didn't even want to listen to me. Christ, I didn't realize I was such a professional leper. Even talking to me can ruin a reputation. He's a skinny, bald-headed old goat, Sally agreed. He's a lecherous old feeler of bottoms and the greatest living authority on ancient writings in the world, I told her bitterly. There was no reply to that, and we sat in forlorn silence for a while. And then Sally perked up. Let's go and fetch him, she suggested. He might refuse to see us, I gloomed. He won't refuse to see me, Sally assured me, and behind the words was an untold story that set my jealousy coursing corrosively through my veins. Sally had worked for him 3 years, and I could only console myself that her standards were high enough to exclude Eldridge Hamilton. 72 hours later, I sat in the front lounge of the Bell at Hurley, with a pint of good English bitter in front of me, and watched the car park anxiously. It was only a 15-minute drive from Oxford, and Sally should have been here long ago. I felt tired, irritable, and depressed from that soul-destroying overnight flight from Johannesburg to Heathrow. Sally had phoned Hamilton from the airport. "Professor Hamilton, I do hope you don't mind me phoning you," she had cooed. "Sally Benneter, do you remember? I worked under you in 1966. "Yes, that's right. Sally Greeneyes." And she giggled coyly. "Well, I'm on my way through England, just here for a day or two. I felt so lonely and nostalgic. Those were wonderful times." Her tone had 100 intimate shades of invitation and promise. "Lunch? Oh, that's wonderful, Professor. Why don't I pick you up? I have a hire car." She gave me a triumphant thumbs-up sign. "The Bell at Hurley. Oh, yes, of course I remember. How could I forget?" She made a sick face at me. "I so look forward to it." The silver Jaguar slid into the car park, and I saw Sally at the wheel. With a scarf in her hair and laughter on her lips, she didn't look like a girl who had sat 14 hours in the cramped seat of an intercontinental jet. She slid out of the car, giving me a flash of those wonderful sun-brown thighs, and then she was coming towards me, hanging on the arm of Eldridge Hamilton, and laughing gaily. Hamilton was a tall, stoop-shouldered man in his 50s. A baggy Harris tweed suit with leather patches on the elbows hung like a sack on his gaunt frame. His nose was beaky, and his bald pate shone in the pale sunlight as though it had been buffed up with a good wax polish. All in all, he wasn't formidable competition, but his little eyes sparkled behind the heavy horn-rimmed glasses, and his lips were slack with desire, exposing a mouthful of bad teeth as he looked at Sally. I found it a hard price to pay for his services. Sally led him to my table, and he was 6 feet from me before he recognized me. He stopped dead, and I saw him blink once. He knew instantly that he'd been taken, and for a moment the whole project hung in the balance. He could so easily have turned on his heel and walked out. "Eldridge," I leapt to my feet, crooning seductively, "how wonderful to see you." And while he still hesitated, I had him by the elbow in a grip like a velvet-lined vice. "I've ordered you a large Gilby's gin and tonic. That's your poison, isn't it?" It was 5 years since we'd last met, and my memory of his personal tastes mollified him slightly. He allowed Sally and I to ease him into a seat and placed the gin convenient to his right hand. While Sally and I bombarded him with all our considerable combined charm, he maintained a suspicious silence until the first gin had gone down. I ordered another, and he began to thaw. Halfway through the third, he became skittish and voluble. "Did you read Wilfred Snell's reply to your book, Offer, in the Journal?" he asked. Wilfred Snell was the most vociferous and merciless of all my scientific adversaries. "Jolly amusing, what?" An Eldridge neighed like a randy stallion and clutched at one of Sally's beautiful thighs. "I am a man of peace, but at that moment I was having difficulty remembering. My expression must have been a sickly grin. My fingernails were driven like claws into the flesh of my palms as I fought down the temptation to drag Eldridge round the room by his heels. Sally wriggled out from his exploring hand, and I suggested in a strangled voice, "Let's go through to lunch, shall we?" There was a quick game of musical chairs at the dining-room table, as Eldridge tried to get a seat within clutching distance of Sally, and I tried to prevent it. We outfoxed him on a cunning double play. Allowing him to settle down triumphantly, beaming over the top of his menu at Sally, who was backed into a corner beside him, before I cried, "Sally, you're in a draft there," and smoothly as a pair of ballet dancers, we changed seats. Then I could relax and give the pheasant the attention it deserved, although the burgundy that Eldridge suggested was nothing if not gauche. With characteristic tact, Eldridge brought up the subject we'd all been flirting with. "Met a friend of yours the other day, big, flashy chap, like a cross between a male model and a professional wrestler. Accent like an Australian with the flu. Had some cock and bull story about scrolls you'd found in a cave outside Cape Town." And Eldridge neighed again at a volume that momentarily stopped all other conversation in the room. "Damned man had the cheek to offer me money. I know the type, not a bean to bless himself with, and talks like he's made of the stuff. Had shyster written all over him in letters 2 feet high." Sally and I gaped at him, struck dumb by his astute grasp of the facts and his masterly summation of Lord Stuyvesant's character. "Sent him packing, of course," said Eldridge with relish, and stuffed his mouth with breast of pheasant. "You probably did the right thing," I murmured. "Incidentally, the site is in northern Botswana, 1,500 miles from Cape Town." Oh, yes?" Eldridge asked, expressing disinterest as politely as one can with a mouthful of pheasant and rotten teeth. "And Lord Stuyvesant was on Time magazine's list of the 30 richest men in the world," murmured Sally. Eldridge stopped chewing with his mouth ajar and afforded us a fine view of a semi-masticated pheasant breast. "Yes," I affirmed. "He's bankrolling my dig. He's put in $200,000 already and has set no limit." Eldridge turned a stricken face towards me. That sort of patron of scientific research was almost as rare as the unicorn. And Eldridge realized suddenly that he'd been within range of one and let him escape. All the bumptiousness was gone out of Professor Hamilton. I signaled the waitress to clear my plate, and I swear that I felt true compassion in my heart for Eldridge as I unlocked my briefcase and took from it a cylindrical bundle wrapped in its protective canvas jacket. "I have an appointment with Reuben Levy in Tel Aviv tomorrow, Eldridge." I opened the canvas wrapping. "We have 1,142 of these leather scrolls, so Ruby will be pretty busy for the next few years. Of course, Lauren Stuyvesant will make a donation of $100,000 to the Tel Aviv University Faculty of Archaeology for their cooperation, and I shouldn't be surprised if the faculty doesn't have some of the scrolls given to them as well." Eldridge swallowed his mouthful of pheasant as though it were broken glass. He wiped his fingers and mouth with his napkin before leaning forward to examine the scroll. "From out of the southern plains of grass," he whispered as he read, and I noticed the difference from Sally's translation, "received 192 large ivory tusks weighing 221 talents." His voice died, but his lips moved as he read on. And then he began speaking again, and his voice quavered with excitement. "Punic, in the style of the 2nd century B.C., you see the use of ligatures to join the median M, still using the hang of the characters from the line. That's definitely pre-1st century B.C. And here, Sally, do you see the archaic crossing of the A?" "We have over 1,000 of these scrolls, preserved in chronological order. Levy is very excited. I interrupted this flow of technicalities with a gentle untruth. Levy didn't know they existed. Levy? Eldridge snorted, and his spectacles flashed with outrage. Levy? Huh. Take him outside Hebrew and Egyptian, and he's a babe in the bloody woods. He had hold of my wrist now. Ben, I insist. I absolutely insist on doing this work. What about Wilfred Snell's criticism of my theories? You seem to find it amusing. I had him by the ackers now, and I could afford to be a little cocky. How do you feel about working with someone whose views are so suspect? Wilfred Snell, said Eldridge earnestly, is a monumental jackass. Where did he ever find 1,000 Punic scrolls? Waiter, I called. Please bring us 2 large Cordon Argent brandies. Make that 3, said Sally. As the brandy diffused its gentle warmth through my body, I listened to Eldridge Hamilton effusing about the scrolls and demanding of Sally information as to exactly where, when, and how we had discovered them. I found myself beginning to like the man. It was true that he had teeth like the stumps of a pine forest devastated by fire, but then I'm not a perfect physical specimen myself. It was also true that he had a weakness for Gilby's gin and pretty girls, but then he differed from me only in his choice of liquor. And who am I to hold that Glen Grant is in any way superior? No, I decided. Despite my prejudices, I would be able to work with him just as long as he kept his bony little claws off Sally. Eldridge followed us out a week after our return to the City of the Moon, and we met him at the airstrip. I was concerned that he might find that the transition from a northern winter to our 110 degrees Fahrenheit summer impaired his abilities. I needn't have worried. He was one of those Englishmen who, solo topi cocked, go out in the midday sun without raising a sweat. His luggage consisted of a single small valise, which contained his personal effects, and a dozen large packing cases filled with chemicals and equipment. I gave him the Grade A tour of the site, trying without success to fan his interest in the city and the cavern. Eldridge was a single-minded specialist. Yes, yes, he said. Yes, jolly interesting. Yes, oh yes, and now where are the scrolls? I think even then he had doubts. But I took him down into the archives, and he purred like an angular old tomcat as he moved down the burdened stone shelves. Ben, he said, there's just one thing still to settle. I write the paper on the actual scrolls. Agreed? We are a strange breed. We work not for the gold, but for the glory. Eldridge was making certain of his share. Agreed, and we shook hands. Well then, there's nothing to stop me beginning right away, he said. No. There isn't, is there? I said.